This podcast is a part of the Blueberry Network. You can find this and other great podcasts at blueberry.com. That's blueberry with no E's .com.
Theater Geeks is a production of the Dufour Creative Network.
Hi, I'm Dave Dufour.
I'm John Schaup.
I'm Marcia Fulmer, and we are Theater Geeks.
Hi, welcome to Theater Geeks, the podcast about community theater and the performing arts. We are joined today by Janet Allen, who is the artistic director at Indiana Repertory Theater down in Indianapolis. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you.
We also have a guest geek with us today as well, in the name of Jessica Hardy, who joined us for an episode on improv and another episode about her film work, and she's going to sit in as well. Tell us a little bit about Indiana Rep and kind of what the structure is, and I know that you just finished doing a production of The House That Jack Built, which coincidentally involved Deirdre Lovejoy, Marcia's daughter, and that was an original show written and premiered there in Indiana, right?
Yes, it was. It was written by our playwright in residence, James Still, who has been our playwright in residence for, goodness, 15 years. We've done many plays of James's. This one was the most recent one, and it did indeed play here and closed in November. So we had a lovely time with it. Its sequel, actually, is being rehearsed right now in California. So the beat goes on about that. It was fun to have Dee Dee here. We hadn't had Dee Dee here in a long, long, long time. So that was a great bit of fun, yeah. So some structure about IRT. IRT is 41 years old now.
Wow.
Founded in the early 70s by three guys who were at Indiana University in the PhD program. And I think all of them got a little itchy to be doing some real work. So they decamped early from Bloomington. And they started looking for a city where they could found a theater, a regional nonprofit, as in the early 70s there were a lot of people doing, due to the wonderful sort of startup money from the Ford Foundation. And they actually wrote letters to many mayors of cities, mostly in the Midwest, but kind of all over. And what ended up happening, making a very long story short, is they received really the best encouragement from the then mayor of Indianapolis, Bill Hudnut. And so they staked out territory up here in Indianapolis, and the theater has two different locations in the both downtown in historic buildings over the last 41 years. We produce a very broad spectrum of work. We produce classics. We produce new work. But the biggest thing about us, guys, that's important to know, which is still kind of a too well-kept secret, I think, is that the IRT serves both adults and children. We have a very broad spectrum of audience reach, and that's very purposeful. There is not a fully professional youth-serving theater in Indiana, and so we perform the function of both of those things. So our programming is balanced between the spread of our audience ages, and so that's really a big engine behind what we do. So you'll see Shakespeare, which we're about to go into rehearsal on in March, of Midsummer Night's Dream, that one particularly because it's taught in school curriculum. And you'll see that right up against a new play like The House That Jack Built that is not a student piece, but is really an adult-serving piece, and that's how we roll. Does that give you a good start?
Good, yeah. Do you involve – now, are all actors paid, or do you also involve some amateur – okay, so it's all professional.
No. Yeah, it's fully professional. Now, it's not the union. We work with three of the three theatrical unions, so it's a fully vocational theater. Our equity contract, of course, gives us some non-pro ratio, but even the non-pros, even the kids, everybody is paid.
I see. And
that is just a piece of how we work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is your typical day down there? I notice you have two productions going at once right now, which is because you have two locations. How do you split your time, or is most of your work tend to be up front and in the pre-launch phase, or is it all the way doing through the production as well?
Oh, my work, the great part about my work is I'm never bored. My day, there's no kind of typical day. I am involved in all phases. So, you know, I could be working, as I did yesterday, I was working on next season. We're still finishing the budgeting on next season, but I'm already starting to hire on it. I'm also dealing with personnel issues in everything we're doing every day.
Yeah.
And
wow.
I'm solving problems about whatever's going on. It just, you know, sometimes I'm in a lot of meetings. Sometimes I'm in rehearsal all day. Mm-hmm. The good part is there's no 2 days the same, which is great fun.
Out of a percentage of shows in a typical year, you're directing what, 50% or
oh, heavens, than? No. I direct one or less a year.
Mm-hmm.
We do between 8 and 10 productions a year, depending on the year. My work is not principally as a director, it's principally as a producer. So that has in part to do with my background. I'm a dramaturg by training, and so directing is not my principal art form. It's not my principal training field.
Okay, we had a question here.
We realized that we were going to be speaking with you today, I wanted to just kind of check out your bio, Janet, so I checked you out.
Yeah,
and
right.
I saw that it said that you were the dramaturg at IRT when you first started. And
right.
I really don't necessarily know what that means. And I'm an artistic director, but that doesn't mean anything. So it's,
it does.
But I'd be curious to know how that works into what is that anyway, I guess. Let's start with that.
Okay. Let's start there.
What the hell's a dramaturg?
It's a really ugly German word. Let's start there.
Yeah, it is.
It's a field that started in the German theater 300 years ago, and it was kind of devised as a more of an academic in a producing institution, and somebody who was charged with doing a lot of background research, contextualizing of work, writing about the work, any kind of historic work that needs to come along out of the play to help the artists know what they're creating. So it began as a job function in the American theater about 25 years ago. That's about right, 30 maybe. When particularly Yale Drama School started training dramaturgs and started a BFA program in dramaturgy, and that was kind of the big cinch pin.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was, and the pragmatics of it in the American nonprofit theater, is that directors and artistic directors no longer have time to do all of their own research, and that a dramaturg on a staff could do that, but also interface very nicely with education departments in theaters. Is kind of the intellectual backstop, is I guess one way to look
okay.
at it.
Now,
so I wrote a lot of when I was a dramaturg, I wrote a lot of program notes, I wrote a lot of study guides, I would do a lot of lecturing about our work, I would do text elucidations for actors and directors and designers so that they know what they're talking about. When they've got a 3-week rehearsal period, they don't have time to do all the deep study mm-hmm. about what does this word mean, what is this a reference to historically. So our staff dramaturg, no longer me, but the wonderful Richard Roberts, begins every rehearsal period by handing the actors a packet of, oh, it could be 20 to 100 pages of text elucidations.
Wow.
That's just the footnotes to the text they're about to start working on.
Right.
So that they don't have to do it themselves. And it's a great field. It's a great field. Dramaturgs in the American theater also are involved in new play developments. They work with playwrights when plays are coming up out of the ground. I hope you guys aren't hearing all the phone beeps. My phone is ringing like mad. Sorry.
That's all right.
Anyway, that's kind of the two bits on dramaturgy.
What is the difference between what a dramaturg has to do for, say, a play like Shakespeare or something quite old like that, as opposed to a modern play like House That Jack Built, for example?
Mm-hmm. Well, the biggest difference is that a dramaturg is sometimes also a text coach in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Which means that they could be the one. Some huge theaters have both. Wouldn't that be gorgeous? They have dramaturgs and text coaches, where they're also functioning as a resource to the actors for how the verse structure works, how the rhythm of a line works. And on Shakespeare, it's really all about those text footnotes helping actors apply that stuff. When we're creating Shakespeare texts, we're cross-referencing three editions of notes, usually from existing editions.
Wow.
So that actors have choices and can get in under what they're saying through three different sets of editorial notes. And we dramaturgs do that upfront work, at least we do here. So it's a lot more text-based on Shakespeare. And then on House That Jack Built, it was actually relatively easy on that from a just text elucidations perspective because it's a contemporary play and there weren't a lot of references to things that we don't know or we don't recognize.
Yeah, right.
What also happened to a certain extent on House of Jack Bell, because it was a premiere, was our staff dramaturg and I were also talking to James about script changes that we thought were useful. So now a dramaturg doesn't prescribe the changes. They ask the questions that might elicit changes from the playwright. Does that make sense, Ben?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's totally not prescriptive. It is not, why don't you change this line to that line? It's, I have a question about this line. And then it elicits conversation. So the point is just to get the conversation worked out.
Okay, I'd like to just kind of change the focus a little bit and ask you how important you think having theater is today, whether it's a repertory theater that serves a huge community like IRT or a community theater like ours, which serves a relatively small area. What's the import today to have one?
What I'd say, Marcia, is you have to have both. I think it's really important to have vocational and avocational theater together. And it's one of the things that's great about Indianapolis. Indianapolis is a huge center of avocational theater. The oldest continuously operating community theater in the country is the Civic Theater here. I think they still hold that accolade. You guys might know better than I, but I think they still do. The act of offering opportunities for people who may have studied theater in high school or college but have chosen not to do it vocationally and have that as an expressive form avocationally, I think is totally key. And it also tells audiences a different story than a professional venue. It tells audiences a story of not only are you there to enjoy the plot and the characters of whatever piece it is, but when it's avocational actors, you're also there to appreciate the do-it-yourselfness, the I'm a banker during the day, but I do this at night. And that is an amazing, wonderful, particularly American story of just anything is possible. The purpose of a professional theater, I think, is different. I think the purpose of a professional theater is that just the act of enlivening people's humanity in the audience. You know, I will say very cynically sometimes, you know, our job is not necessarily to have all kinds of fun while we're doing this, although I hope we do, and if we're having fun, we're making better art. But our job is to impact an audience, to impact an emotional change in audiences.
Right.
And I think there's never been a time when we need that more than now. And I think the need for theater as an art that touches people's lives in a live way is going to grow as we get more and more isolated by technology, as we get more and more surrounded by violence, as we get more and more xenophobic. We need what theater delivers, which is that moment where we all say, wait a minute, we all do care about the same things. Mm-hmm. We all do care about raising children safely. We all do care about having a decent community. We all do care about, you know, making the world a better place and a more a tolerant place. And that's what theater does through the power of storytelling. And it does it far better, I'm convinced, than any other art form because it's the live act in front of the live audience.
Right. Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Oh, you guys have heard this diatribe before, I bet.
Oh, hey,
no, like but we it. Just yeah, all like agree with you.
Yeah, that's right. We're just basking in the wonderment here.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I was curious. How do you? You know, you were talking about. You know, we maybe need theater now more than ever because of a lot of the things that you mentioned, changes in society. How have audiences changed over the last 20 or 30 years? Do you think?
That's the way I feel too, Janet.
Do you think?
Tell you a couple of superficial things.
All right.
We no longer even attempt to keep them from bringing their liquor into the theater with them.
Oh God!
Wow.
And we're on the very verge of creating tweet seats.
Oh, you're kidding!
Tweet seats?
No, I think we probably will, Marcia.
Oh my God!
What's that? What?
Well.
So
is it someplace where
no.
People can sit and tweet while the performance is going on?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wouldn't that be horrendously annoying?
Well, you know, there's some theaters pioneering it, and it actually isn't that annoying. Listen, for years I was the person laying down on the railroad track saying they cannot bring their – nobody can bring any liquid into the theater. It will be annoying to the audience, to the actors. And I finally had to give that up, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And you know what? It really doesn't matter.
Well, as long as they don't slop it all over or, you know, kick their glasses.
Yeah, the part I hate is when they kick the glass in the big, quiet moment.
Right,
here's the thing, guys. We are already so utterly unable to get people to turn their cell phones off in the theater. You can't, it doesn't matter. We curtain speech every single performance we do.
Yeah.
We do over 300 performances a year, and we curtain speech every single one. It doesn't matter. People consider their electronics now their right in the world.
I'm curious. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I think we're going to end up with tweet seats where you take an isolated, we'd take a sort of upper corner of the balcony on small nights, you know, on Tuesday, Wednesday nights to try it out.
Okay.
And see what happens.
Oh.
And there'd be like, there'd be 10 seats and you
tweet
see what happens.
Wow.
That's wild.
Well, I was just going to...
Wait, Jessica has a question.
I was going to intercept because you're talking a little bit about what I've encountered. I worked in at a commercial theater in Chicago for 6 years. So the liquor and the audiences, that's big. But now I run the film festival. And one thing that I'm curious what your take is on this is the fine line between the art... running it as an artistic endeavor, and then the business side. you want to keep people happy, you want them to return, you have to keep things running smoothly. So when you're talking about keeping drinks out of the theater, do you worry about those kinds of things in terms of you have to still keep those audience members coming back?
That's right.
If they get drunk, will you throw them out?
I'm sorry, Marcia.
I said, if they get drunk, will you throw them out?
Yeah, we have done that. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
But that's not really the issue at all. People who are at, it's a very rare moment that people are at the theater to get so wasted that they're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
It just isn't. It is not a common problem. So, sure, we worried about that a lot when we first started admitting drinks into the theater. And this isn't just alcohol, guys. This is all
no.
You can take your soda and your water and your coffee.
Yeah, it was 3 years ago for us. So, yeah, I understand.
You cannot forbid that anymore in a reasonable business model. That is, we have chosen not to. Maybe other people do choose to exclude that. You know, Jessica, every decision we make every day as producers is that. How do you balance the art with the commerce? How do you keep the integrity of the art as high as you can and still make it as accessible to an audience? And here's the part we have to remember, but guys, because we aren't these people. Keeping it as accessible to people to whom theater is a foreign entity.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
Because we have to not just keep the theater goers we have. We have to proselytize. We have to build audiences all the time because this is not an art form that sits at the center of a culture. It's an art form that sits on the periphery of a culture. And you don't want to get me started on why it's got to do with Puritans and all kinds of things.
Yes, yes, it does.
You know, that's a much longer story, but we are not in the safe position of getting to choose who our audience is. We have to try to figure out how to get new people into the theater all the time. And I will tell you that our barrier, at least here in Central Indiana, is not so much money. It is people calling and saying, do I have to wear a tuxedo? Will I understand what's going on? Do you have to have a college degree to come sit in your audience? And they're not saying that we're going to, you know, frisk them at the door and look at their papers. But what they're asking is this, is what happens in your theater going to make me feel stupid?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh,
wow.
Hmm. Wow.
But that's an opportunity, though.
Well, sure it is, but it's also a huge barrier. This state is what, 46th or 47th?
Oh, please.
Way at the bottom of the 50 states in level of education.
Right. And not getting any better.
No.
So let me ask you this, and that also must figure in to whatever choices you make for a season. How do you look at that?
Well, that to me, Marcia, is opportunity.
Okay.
Here's the good part. Virtually every play we do, doesn't matter how old it is, audiences are going to perceive as a new play because they don't see very much theater. I'll give you a great example. So a few years ago, when my predecessor was in my job, Libby Apple, amazing artistic director of Oregon Shakespeare Festival for 10 years after she left here, her final production when she was artistic director was Shakespeare's Tempest. And I was the associate artistic director at that point, and I was saying to a board member, a very savvy board member, mind you, Libby's Tempest is going to be like no Tempest you have ever seen. You're not going to believe it. And he said, Janet, I don't want to see the Tempest like nobody's ever seen before. I want to see the Tempest because I've never seen it before. So I don't want to see the spin version. I want to see the play. Okay. So what all this means, guys, is everything we do is like a new play to our audience because most of the time they haven't seen it, or a vast majority haven't seen it. Now, we don't tend to do, you know, Little Shop of Horrors.
Good.
Yeah, well, we just don't for a bunch of reasons, mostly because we we produce a lot more classics than that. But so that's privilege to me. That is like a blank slate. You can imprint on somebody their memory of the Glass Menagerie, of Midsummer Night's Dream, because they haven't seen him before. So I find that some days daunting, but most days extremely exciting, because we get to kind of define the craft for people.
It's neat.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
It does mean that we're picking. So in a way, it kind of frees me from worrying about too much of this, because I want there to be a couple of name recognizable things on a season. But other than that, I've got a lot of latitude to select things, to produce things. They expect to be surprised. That's great. That's such an invitation.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
It is good. I mean, we just real quick, we had 6 shows in our season, our main stage season this year, that we've never produced before. And our season ticket sales went up this year instead of down.
Isn't that something?
We worried so much about having to do things that people had heard of before. And apparently we may have been at least partly wrong or misjudging it a little bit. Yeah.
Well, I think with IRT, people know.
Right.
And this is what we have to build into, and hopefully we are, that no matter what the name of the play is, whether they've seen it 10 times or never seen it, they're really going to see a good production that will give them an enjoyable evening.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah.
And that's what we're kind of working toward, to build that trust in our audiences so that they know no matter what they're going to see, it's going to be a good production, and they may not like the play, but they'll like what they see.
Yeah, they'll feel like they've had a quality experience.
Right, right.
That's what
right.
most people are after anyway.
Right.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank Janet Allen, for the artistic director for the Indiana Repertory Theater, for joining us. And I can't let you go without mentioning that if you are in the Midwest and you're interested in seeing some great theater, you go to irtlive.com. Do I have that right?
Yeah, thanks.
And look for what's coming next. Right now, I know you've got Midsummer Night. That's not Midsummer Night's Dream. A Little Night Music, and and Jackie and Me, which is a Jackie Robinson
right.
story. Going by the time this
right.
podcast hits, those will be kind of done and over with. But what? Tell us a little bit about The Whipping Man.
Oh, The Whipping Man is an amazing recent play, not brand new, guys. I think came out in about 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It's a American Civil War story involving. It's set at the end of the Civil War in a ruined mansion in Richmond, Virginia, where the young white master comes home and is greeted by one of the old family slaves, and he's greeted by it. The slave greets this young white master in Hebrew. It turns out that this family is Jewish. The slaves were embraced into that religion and observe that religion themselves. And so they sit down in the ruins of this mansion with all kinds of conflicts, mind you, about redefined roles, about
right.
freedom and slavery. But the little-known fact of that period of time, the second week of April in 1865, is it was Passover. And so they observe Passover as they try to redefine these relationships between themselves. So it's a really startling very interesting play.
And is that that's in your black box or on your main stage?
No, it's on the main stage.
Main stage, right. Interesting.
And that starts March 5th. This year, 2013, and then you have the Youth Conservatory for Youth. Is that that's an educational program then?
Yeah, it's essentially a summer camp, which we've been doing for about 15 years.
Cool.
It's about 70 or 80 kids are here for a month, trained entirely by professionals, and very exciting work. We've loved our conservatory. It has a playwriting arm. It's got a production arm. It's got an acting arm. So they get a really broad range of experiences to choose from.
Very
kids 8 to 18.
Well, It's all there, irtlive.com. Check it out. Thanks very much, Janet, for joining us once again.
That wraps up
this episode of Theater Geeks. Remember that you can find us on iTunes at the Zune Marketplace. We are on your iPhone or your Android device with Stitcher Smart Radio. Device, that's right. And I guess we might as well mention it. You can go to our online store where you will find
All kinds of good stuff.
Things. That's right. Okay, Marcia.
Wonderful coffee.
Waving her finger at us, saying, "Don't you dare say the thing that rhymes with teddy bear." Right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say it because Janet is a guest.
That's right. Okay. All right. So anyway, it's at theatergeeks.com. You can listen to the podcast there as well. Also, thank Jessica Hardy for being with us in this episode. I'm Dave Dufour.
I'm John Chow.
I'm Marcia Fulmer, and we are Theater Geeks.
Music for Theater Geeks was provided by MusicAlley.com.